Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Ken is my boss at Stanford, where we work in the philosophy department.
Even though you're the smarter one.
Oh, thanks, Ken. Philosophy is nice work if you can get it, as Charlie Bird reminds us. This week's episode is coming to you live from Philosophy Corner at Stanford University.
Oh, there you go again, John. We're not on campus. We're not at Philosophy Corner. We're at KALW San Francisco, our presenting station.
Ken, what's our topic this week?
It's the question of, would you want to live forever?
Now, we need to be clear. We're not talking about religion here. I mean, a lot of you out there in Radio Land would like to be saved, and a lot of you probably would just as soon not be saved. But we're not talking about that kind of immortality.
We're talking about immortality as a human being here on Earth.
Right. Just to imagine being as you are, or maybe as you were when you were a bit healthier and happier, and just continuing to live forever, never dying. Would you like to do that or not?
Well, this seems to be an easy question. I mean, there's a pretty simple argument you can give. I mean, first part, dying is a bad thing, right? You agree about that, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, for most cases, yeah, unless you're in terrible pain or something.
Right, right. So why is death such a bad thing? It's not because of death, because death is nothing, right?
Let's assume for the sake of argument that being dead is nothing. There's
okay.
There's nothing bad about being dead. It's just getting dead that is sometimes very painful.
I mean, you can imagine getting dead in a not very painful way, right? But still, it's a bad thing to die. Why? Well, it's not because of the death. It's because of what death takes away from us. It takes away life. Life is a good thing, and death deprives us of it. Now, here's my argument. Life is a good thing. More of a good thing is better than less of a good thing. So wouldn't you want more life rather than less life?
Up to a point. Two things. First of all, we're not asking whether on any given day you're going to choose to die the next day, even though you're in good health and everything. We're talking about right now, looking at it dispassionately. You say, would it be good for me to live forever or not?
Right.
And then... To your other point, I'd say, look, I mean, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, it goes on and on, but it's really good. And when it ends, you almost would like more. But if it went on for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours more or a century more.
Well, right. I mean, but that would get monotonous. That's true. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. But, you know, after you listen to the ninth, you can listen to the seventh. You can listen to the fifth. You can do more and more things, different things. And let me give you. Okay, suppose you're 95 years old and you've lived a good, happy life. You're in full health. And I say to you, John, would you like one more day? What are you going to say?
I would say you just committed the first fallacy that I reminded you of a minute ago.
We're not asking
whether on a given day you're going to choose to die. We're saying, lifting yourself up from your life, looking at a dispassionate view, you're going to say, well, is it a good thing for me to live forever, a good thing for me? Or even if at the moment it happens I'm not exactly happy about it, wouldn't it be better if my life had a shape?
Yeah.
If I could make plans, if it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, if at 90 years old maybe I could watch my son, who would then be 70, assume the leadership of the family without this grandfather hanging around, and my daughter and my younger son
I get it. You got pretty high standards.
Life ought to have a shape.
I mean, you got pretty high standards. Well, if life ought to have a shape, then, you know, you need to get in shape, John. But anyway, now you've got pretty high standards. I mean, I think life would just be pleasant. Just be pleasure, and you could enjoy things for a very, very long time, you know?
Would you like to live forever? Let us know what you think. Join our discussion at 415-841-4134.
Especially tell us the circumstances under which you'd like to live forever. We've asked, now we have our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen. She's going to give us a look into the practical possibilities of immortality. Her report starts with the humor of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man. That's old.
In 1960, a phenomenon came to the attention of the world. Man claiming to be 2,000 years old was proven by our foremost medical authorities to be just that.
How old is the oldest person you know? 80, 90, 100 years old? Did you ever think you'd make it to be even older than that?
You are now 2013.
Yes.
What has kept you alive?
Will to live.
Ah, yes, that is the will to live.
Not the will to live. Doctor to live. Doctor will to live.
I think there's no question that the potential of us all living to 120 is there.
Dr. Philip Miller from California's Los Gatos Longevity Institute.
I mean, just think about the turn of the century. You know, the average age that you die was about 47. Now it's 78. That age is going to keep creeping up no matter what we do.
Is it really going to keep on creeping up until we're 100, 200, 2,000 years old?
What is aging? We don't know, is the short answer.
That's Bill Hurlbut, a consulting professor in biology at Stanford University and a member of the President's Council on Bioethics.
The major parties of argument in this are, one is aging is the cumulative effect of all the generalized breakdown in the body. And by that theory, anything you do to treat any one of the organ systems will help the overall system and perhaps add a little more life.
So say you get new lungs, heart, kidneys. Your body would last longer, but you might not enjoy it much.
Okay, now the second theory is that there is a unitary process called aging that inevitably afflicts any cells in the body. And if there is an inbuilt senescence to cell life, then there might be something called aging.
In that case, there may be some way to turn back the process or at least slow it down, but scientists are a long ways from finding it. Until then, there are a few tricks which seem to work. Precise doses of antioxidants like vitamin E may help extend life, and Hurlbut, who skips both breakfast and lunch, says that eating less may also help.
Sir, what was your diet like 2,000 years ago?
2,000 years ago, we only ate what God meant, the organic, the natural.
Like what?
Clouds, stars, rocks.
Turns out that caloric restriction is genuinely effective in increasing longevity. When they calorically restrict mice, they can live, I think, 50 to 70% longer, something like that. It's in that order of magnitude.
But the more complex the animal, the harder it is to extend life. Relatively speaking, humans already have fairly long lifespans. Hurlbut says we may have evolved this way because things like wisdom and life experience, which take a while to get, actually help the species survive.
Across time, the evolutionary process increased both complexity and longevity, so that older and older living creatures evolved.
If that's true, maybe we just aren't built to live any longer than we already do. It may just be a matter of natural selection.
Which doesn't mean that we won't all live longer. It just means that we will come eventually against, at least on the average, a kind of a maximal lifespan, which I wouldn't be at all surprised ends up being something like 120 to 140 years.
I have over 42,000 children, and not one comes to visit me.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Against Mel Brooks, it's not that he's not an expert, but it's time now for a more expert opinion.
John Fisher is going to join us from KPCC in Pasadena. John was once an undergraduate at Stanford. He went on, in spite of that, to become a famous and influential philosopher, earning his PhD at Cornell University and teaching at Yale and the University of California at Riverside. He has written books on life and death, good and bad, right and wrong, free will and determinism, and lots of other stuff.
Professor Fisher is the director of the Honors Program at the University of California, Riverside. He's the editor of the book, The Metaphysics of Death, and the author of such texts as Why Death is Bad and Why Immortality is Not So Bad.
Even though he has accomplished a great deal in a short amount of time, this young philosopher apparently wants to live forever. John Fisher, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you very much, John and Ken. It's great to be here.
John, Ken couldn't give me any good reasons for wanting to live forever. Can you do better?
Well, I'll give it a shot. The first thing I should say is I disagree with one part in the introduction where you suggested that I was more of an expert on these matters than Mel Brooks. I think that when we tend to worry about immortality, we have incorrect pictures in our minds of immortality. Maybe we're thinking of Sisyphus rolling that rock up and down the hill forever, or being in the dentist chair forever and having chronic pain.
Ooh, that sounds awful, John.
But pictures that involve tedium, boredom, or even chronic pain are just kind of some ways of envisaging immortality. I'd prefer to think of immortality along the lines of our own finite lives, except much longer. In our finite lives, as we live them, yes, sometimes we're in terrible pain. Sometimes we have a toothache or a headache or a chronic pain. Sometimes we're bored, although, of course, never in a philosophy lecture.
Right, never with John Perry as your co-host.
Exactly, or listening to Philosophy Talk. But then sometimes we have great moments of ecstatic pleasure or a sense of reward after pursuing a project and fulfilling it. I can't see why immortality couldn't be the same way.
Well, John, in a philosophy lecture, I certainly never get bored, but one of the reasons is I have an idea that it's of a finite length. It's going to end. Even if it's Ken lecturing, that's somewhat comforting. When we're reflective about it, isn't that true of life as a whole? I mean, what flavor would our accomplishments have? What pride could we have if there was just this... Everything we did would just be a second in something that went on forever.
Right, John. Right.
Well, I never...
Go ahead, John.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. I never get bored in my own lectures, but... No, what I would say is...
I get bored in my own lectures, to tell you the truth.
What can give life a sense of meaning and purpose and energy is that we do take risks. We do make choices with the possibility of terrible consequences, and that would still be true even in an immortal life. We tend to think of death, perhaps, as the only bad consequence or the only thing that could give life a shape or a structure, but that's not true at all. Yep. Even if we were immortal, we could still suffer from pain and disability.
That's
and
true.
Disappointment.
That's true, but I mean, if you're immortal and you can suffer from pain and disappointment and being crushed by a falling boulder or something like that, I mean, that makes it even more terrifying in a certain way, because you're giving up, if you die, an infinite good, you know, an infinite life that you would have had. That seems, I mean, it's one thing to give up a year, to die a year too soon, but to die an eternity too soon? That sounds very depressing.
But I mean, in our life, you can when you get so old, you can say, well, you know, at least they're not going to live forever. I seem to have made it through without ever leaving my children hungry or cheating anybody too bad or running over a cat with my car or having a boulder fall on me or losing a leg. But if you're going to live forever, you can be pretty sure that the probability is very high that all those things will happen to you. Everything you could do wrong, you eventually will do wrong. Maybe I'm just pessimistic.
Yeah, you are pessimistic. But what do you think about that, John Fisher? I mean, there's an argument there. I mean, how do you respond to that argument?
I think it's a good argument. I think that if I knew that I would actually live forever and I'm not invulnerable, that is, I'm still... vulnerable to pain and disappointment and tedium and depression, then I know that there are many risks. I know that I have to be careful about what I decide. I know I have to, let's say, watch my cholesterol and work out. I know that there are risks, but that, again, is something that makes an immortal life still potentially at least worth living, meaningful. It gives it a shape. Now, I think it is, John's point and Ken's point raises a very interesting question about perhaps the difference between an immortal life and a finite life. I know that if I were to live forever, lots of bad things will happen to me. Not only will I sprain my ankle, but I'll perhaps suffer from various infirmities.
Well, one bad thing's going to happen to you right now. Ken's going to cut you off.
Yeah, because we'd like to give our listeners a chance to join us. You can join us at 415-481-4134. You can also send us email at philosophytalk.perry@stanford.edu. We want to hear from you. Tell us, would you like to live forever and under what circumstances?
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break. Bob Dylan, may you be forever young, or would that you had remained forever young.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
It's time to take your calls. We're discussing immortality with Professor John Fisher of the University of California at Riverside.
You tell us, are there any circumstances under which you'd want to live forever? Would you care most about getting more done? Having more and more experiences? Experiencing different things? Feeling more and different kinds of pleasures? Or would you choose not to live forever? How long would you like to live?
To join our discussion, call 415-841-4134 or write us email at philosophytalk.perry@stanford.edu. We have a caller on the line. That's Joel in Sedona. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joel.
At Sonoma.
Sonoma.
Isn't that what I
said? Sonoma, California, the heart of the wine country.
Ah, it's nice up there.
Yeah, it is.
So what's your question, Joel?
Well, I'd like to hear your response to, you know, the first of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths. And I suppose you could relate this to the point that John Fisher was just making. It's not just that you're going to be vulnerable to suffering and, you know, broken ankles and have to watch your cholesterol and so on and so forth. You're condemned to it. So it goes. Suffering goes with the territory.
So that's
I guess part of what motivates my question is that it seems to me that there's a whole wisdom tradition in which the point of life is to prepare oneself for relinquishing it.
I think that's a good point.
So gracefully.
A good point, Joel. We might say that a lot of wise people, including religious leaders, have thought that suffering was really more intrinsic to life in some ways than joy.
Yeah.
And a lot of religions have thought, you know, getting out of this life and into ratcheting up into a better one was pretty important. Now, whether they were right about what happens when we get out of this life,
their
insights about the nature of this life shouldn't be ignored.
Yeah, haven't gotten any report back from the other side, unfortunately. You know,
you think those religions were misguided, Professor Fisher?
Thanks, Joel.
Oh, no, not at all. And I agree that life is full of suffering and pain, and part of the point of life is how we address and how we deal with it.
But you don't think a life devoid of suffering, of disappointment, of pain, that would be a good life. It might not be a life easy to achieve, but wouldn't that be a good life, John Fisher?
It would be a very different kind of life, and not recognizably a human life, but I think the kind of life that we could aspire to. I don't think the point of life is to prepare ourselves for death or to prepare ourselves for being transported to some other kind of existence. I don't know what awaits us.
Yeah. Sounds like you and the Buddha could have a good discussion. You wouldn't agree about everything. Let's take our next caller. Who's that, Ken?
Richard in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to mention that George Bernard Shaw wrote a play called Man and Superman, in which everyone was immortal, but they developed a philosophy that life was futile because eventually everyone died because they were struck by lightning or had some other accident.
Yeah, so
they were kind of contingently immortal. They were immortal as long as they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't just die.
They got really bored with their. Is that what you're?
Yes.
Yeah.
And insurance actuaries have calculated that if everyone were immortal, that the average lifespan would still be only 200 years because.
What, they kill each other?
Would eventually die in some kind of accident.
Or they'd kill each other out of sheer boredom. They want some excitement. Thanks for the call, Joel. What do you think about that, John Fisher?
I think there's something a bit incoherent about the description of that case, but I do agree. Certainly, life insurance agents would go out of business, I assume, if we were all immortal, but we'd still need health insurance, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you, I want to get back to a question that was raised by somebody. I can't remember who. You said you don't think the purpose of life is to prepare for death and transition to some other phase.
Right.
I think that's right, but then what is the purpose of life? I mean, can you have an answer
to
that
question? Well, that's
just to live
one.
It, just to, you know, enjoy things and
Maybe you'll have to invite me back for another episode of Philosophy Talk to discuss the meaning of life. But actually, to try and come to grips with that. Actually, I think most of us in our ordinary lives are more concerned with mortality than immortality. Just driving over here to Pasadena from Riverside on the freeways, I was a bit concerned about my own mortality. But when we step back and we think about the question of whether we might find immortality desirable, it naturally leads to questions about what the meaning of life is and what makes a life worthwhile.
John, I know you've got children. You love them very much. For most of us, isn't a large part of the meaning of life come from doing things for other people and often for our children, for our families? If everybody was immortal, We couldn't just have 42,000 children apiece. We'd have to just kind of taper off the whole child thing, or we'd crowd the earth. This is just something right. kind of illogical about destroying human life when it's all we know that's of value in that way?
That is a hard question. It's a difficult question. Now that President Bush has announced the intention of going of colonizing the moon and then Mars, it points to the idea that possibly we'd be able to colonize other planets in the future. And
many people think of San Francisco as
another planet.
As
right.
another planet. Right.
Let's get an email question in here. You can always reach us via email at philosophytalk.perry@stanford.edu. And here's a question from Carlos from Los Angeles. Carlos writes, "Dear John and Ken, if part of what gives life its meaning is what you do with that life, then has someone who lived for 40 years and accomplished X lived a less meaningful life than someone who's lived for 60 years and accomplished X and Y, where Y is something laudable and does generally take 20 years to accomplish? So is your life less meaningful if you've lived a shorter time, right, because you've done less?" What do you think about that, either John or John? John Fisher.
Well,
okay. I think that we use the term meaningful life in various different ways. For me, to have a meaningful life is to live with free will, to construct a plan of life freely, and to seek to act in accordance with that plan. What one accomplishes is less important, in my view, yeah. than what one seeks to accomplish. And also, John is absolutely right that love of one's family and one's friends is a central part, I think, of any more richly meaningful life.
Right. So an immortal life without that, without one's family and friends, suppose you were the only immortal, that would just right. be sadness. But let's hear from some more callers. Rick in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Rick.
Hi, thanks. You know, one of the assumptions seems to be that life will continue along as it has been if we keep on living for a long time. But, you know, even if we solve the pressing ecological and population sort of problems that confront us at this point, eventually the sun will burn out.
Well, that's true.
You know, we'll all be burnt to a crisp unless somehow we manage to fly to some other star. But eventually, those will all burn out as well.
And that pushes one of my buttons, frankly, Rick. I mean, like this business of going to the moon and Mars and colonizing them. It's like we've got the Earth. Everything we've got comes from the Earth. Our life,
yeah.
Everything we know that's good, and that's pointless. Let's take care of the Earth,
and
instead of immortality, and putting a lot of money into making people live longer and longer, let's try
you're
to take care of the lives we've got and make them decent.
You're getting on a soapbox.
I am
John.
Getting on a soapbox.
Thanks for the call, Rick.
Well, I agree with John, by the way. I don't like the idea of colonizing the planets as a way of solving these problems. But this is, in a way, a paradigmatic philosophical problem. It's not exactly a practical problem, although it raises interesting practical problems about euthanasia and also population control and ecological issues. But it's kind of, to me, a thought problem. And the fact that our resources are limited really doesn't go to the essence of the problem. And the essence of the problem is, could we conceive of circumstances in which it would be desirable to be immortal?
Yeah,
we're doing that conceiving on Philosophy Talk with Ken Taylor and John Perry.
We're talking to John Fisher about the question, would you want to live forever? Join us at 415-841-4134. We have a caller on the line. That's Adam in San Francisco is next up. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Adam.
Thanks, guys. You know, as per your last point, that you're conceiving the circumstances of it in which immortality would be reasonable, I mean, you kind of have to arbitrarily draw the line as to how much you want to restructure society. At this point, you know, our income earning potential reaches its peak at a certain age, and then we're able to provide ourselves in retirement. If you are immortal, your income earning potential potentially goes way down.
That's certainly
while your
true.
Needs go up.
That's certainly true, Adam. I mean, it's true that the society in which we now live is not a society which even presupposes, you know, that people are going to live to 500, let alone forever. Well, that's certainly true. I mean, we're not, I don't think we're really, but what are we trying to get at when we ask this question? I think we're trying to get at, what is a human life for? Does it have a kind of natural ending point? When is it exhausted? When are its possibilities exhausted?
Is it an important aspect of the worth of a human life and what we like about it that it's finite?
Right, and you could think of the example of a sculpture, for instance. A sculpture is what it is because it has boundaries and borders, and if it didn't, it would just be this huge blob of marble, let's
but
say.
It's striking to me, John Fisher, that you say that, because you're the guy who wants to live forever. And the, but
right, well,
John, I still don't think you've answered John Perry's worry that an immortal life would necessarily be shapeless. It would be a series.
Right.
I mean, just think about the life of an Alzheimer's patient. That's a sad thing. You know, my father-in-law died of Alzheimer's. It's a sad thing to watch somebody. And what's so bad about Alzheimer's? Well, from the patient's point of view, maybe not that much. I mean, it's bad, but not. But from our point of view, watching him, we see this person lose the entire narrative structure. You know, the entire connecting fold of his or her life. It's just a
right.
series of moments disconnected. Well, from the point of view of immortality, of eternity, anything you do in our lives would be like that. You just have these series of disconnected moments with no narrative structure.
What's the point of having done something 6,000 years ago if you can't remember it? It might as well have been somebody else.
Let's hear from our callers. There's Linda from Berkeley on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Linda.
Hello. My mother passed away recently at 94, and I was taking care of her in a special care facility. This is not a convalescent home, but a special care facility, and there was quite a lot of dementia.
Yeah, my father-in-law was in such a place.
Yeah. And I got a chance to really see what living without living was like and what living with living. I mean, every day they were glad to be alive, but every day they forgot what happened the day before. Now, my mother had her facilities, and she had the ability to live her life fully up to within 2 months of her death at 94. But what I came to realize was that it is an issue of quality, sometimes versus quantity.
Yeah.
And I would take the quality anytime, because these people have the quantity. You know, they're living on, but they don't know their own keepers sometimes, you know, from morning till afternoon. The other thing is, you know, in a perfect world where we don't deteriorate and our bodies don't deteriorate and our friends don't die off and we're not left alone, sure, I mean, but this isn't the perfect world, and we're not going to see that
right.
for quite a while. And in the meantime, the reality is, I'll take the quality versus the quantity.
Right. I understand that, Linda, but let me ask you a question. If you got 95 and were in perfect health, in control of your faculties, and I said to you, you can have one more day, would you take that one more day?
Well, first of all, in the real world, you wouldn't have perfect health.
I know. This is philosophy. We can imagine alternative worlds.
No, but let's take the real world. She
no,
had
no, I want to take the alternative world.
She had good health.
Yeah, okay.
But she had things that were beginning to break down.
Right.
And the main thing was she couldn't do for herself anymore. And for different people, different issues will be the thing that will, you know, put them over the edge. And for her, it was not being able to do for herself. And so each person has to make that decision. But she came to the conclusion about 6 months before she passed. She started saying, I'm ready. I've had a wonderful life, a fulfilling life. I've done the things I wanted to do. And I'm ready. And she prepared us.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks very much, Linda.
I'll answer your question, Ken. Yes, I can imagine being 95 in good health and saying, you know, this would be a good day to die. This is kind of what I thought my life would be like. I can't improve what I've already done. And
that one extra day just has no appeal to you.
Oh, it would have appeal, but... Yeah.
John Fisher, you want to weigh in there?
Maybe John's thinking of there being a department meeting on that next day.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It would have to be a Tuesday.
What I'd like to say, yes, quality is more important than quantity. There are many circumstances in which immortality would not be desirable, pain, boredom, Alzheimer's. All I am saying is that there are some conceivable circumstances in which it would be attractive. And I do think it has to do with the structure of the narrative of one's life. And ultimately, the question might be, doesn't the narrative have to have a beginning, middle, and end in order to be recognizably the story right. of a good human life? After all, many people watch soap operas, and it's not clear that they ever come to an end.
We have a caller in the line, John from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Thank you very much. I'd like to make a suggestion that perhaps life is not a good, and so that the extinction of it would be a bad.
Ooh.
Maybe it's just a neutral thing. Maybe it's something like, an example would be maybe a hammer, which could build a house or it could kill a person. And the hammer itself is just a neutral thing. It's how it's used that makes it good and bad.
Yeah.
And I think life itself and how we behave in life, those things can be judged to be good and bad. But life itself, I don't think, can be judged as good, a good.
Yeah.
And so the death is not a bad.
Well, I don't know. I mean, each person seems to regard his or her own life as a good for that person, because each, except for in very special circumstances, people would rather not die.
I think there is an important distinction between being good for someone and being good in some objective sense. I can think of many lives, not just Hitler's and a few really bad ones like that, that it was not good that that life existed. It wasn't good at all.
John,
world was a worse place for it. But for Hitler, his life was a good. It was something he valued.
John Fisher, do you want to weigh in on whether life is a good, intrinsic good? Quickly, we got 1 minute to break.
Well, I agree with John that you have to distinguish good for the individual from another notion of good, like good for the world or good for the community. I'm inclined to think that the nature of human life and human consciousness with free will is intrinsically a good, although it can be easily outweighed by significant pain.
So coming up, our own 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes. He's going to drop by to give us an overview of the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard.
It's more Philosophy Talk after this short break. Forever, Joe Jackson. Now, that would be cool. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
This week, would you like to live forever? We'll take some more calls, but first, let's learn a little about what some of the great philosophers of the past may have said about the subject of death and dying and immortality.
It's time for a regular Philosophy Talk feature, the 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes. Ian talks fast, so listen carefully. This time, he sums up the life and accomplishments of Kierkegaard in just about 1 minute. Ready? Go!
Ian Scholes, Søren Kierkegaard was an odd bird. He wrote about the importance of passion, yet avoided its manifestations. He was a rich man, but he died broke. A prolific writer, he seldom wrote under his own name, instead employing pseudonyms, each with a point of view slightly different from Kierkegaard's own. He speaks to our age as a forerunner of existentialism with his premise that knowledge can only be gained through subjectivity. But he was always searching for an absolute. He was obsessed with dread, anguish, and despair, but was witty and lively, writing about them. He was a lover of paradox, of irony. He also speaks to us in his contempt for the media and in his simultaneous courting of the media. In his later years, he died at 42 in 1855, he provoked a feud with a popular Danish satirical magazine, wondering why they hadn't made fun of him yet. The magazine promptly did, and Kierkegaard became the laughingstock of Denmark. Often seen in Copenhagen, he was stoop-shouldered with a jerky way of walking and was easily caricatured. Parents would tell their children, "You don't want to grow up to be a Sora, now do you?" He was kind of the Michael Jackson of 19th-century Denmark. The ridicule finished him as a man taken seriously, but typically he both relished and regretted the contempt. In Scandal's aftermath, he wrote what many think is his greatest work, The Sickness Unto Death, under the pseudonym Anticlimacus. It is about various forms of despair. Despair of ever finding God, despair of not even knowing that one is looking to find God, despair of being mortal, despair of being immortal and not being able to accept it, and so forth. Kierkegaard delighted in denial, and whether on Judgment Day he argues with the angels or sleeps with the worms, he's attained a certain measure of immortality, or its sickly twin, fame. In Sickness Unto Death, he wrote, quote, "The biggest danger, that of losing oneself, can pass off in the world as quietly as if it were nothing. Every other loss, an arm, a leg, $5, a wife, etc., is bound to be noticed." Unquote. I gotta go.
So, John Fisher, you know, Ian Scholes just mentioned Kierkegaard's Sickness Unto Death. And in that essay, as I recall, you know, it's been a while, he talks about despairing because you can't face death. You can't face the fact that you're mortal. You don't want to die, but you can't bear the thought of living a merely human life to infinity because of the interminable doubt and all that stuff. Now, most religions, I think all religions say, living a merely human life, that would be to eternity. That would be a very bad thing. Now, you're a big fan of living the merely human life to eternity. Are those religions wrong? I mean, what's going on here? Tell me what you think about that.
Religion encapsulates a certain kind of wisdom, practical wisdom. We read religious works and we participate in religious activities and rituals and communities in order, I think, to get that distilled wisdom about human life. And human life as we know it is finite. What I think is interesting about thinking about the possibility of infinite life, even embodied in the way we are embodied, is that it helps us to get to the essence of what matters in human life. But I agree that human life as we know it is finite, and we have to come to grips with it, and religion is one wonderful, excellent way of coming to grips with
human life. Is there anything that would even be possibly, you know, for a human being that would be worth doing forever? I mean, human life as we know it is racked with all kinds of problems. But can we even imagine a life that's just a human life that we'd say, we want that forever?
Right. I think so, but not just one activity. Some philosophers have thought in terms of a single activity. But I think a mixture of activity, of caring for others, of enjoying one's family, of thinking about mathematics and science and philosophy, of enjoying fine wines and meals and so forth, a mix of activities.
Let me ask you this, John. A minute ago we distinguished between being good in some sense for the community, for the world, and being good for a given person.
Yes.
Now let's shift to the picture of what's good for the world, what's good for the community. Imagine having 600 years of experiences, and one way is you've got 100 people that each live for 600 years, and the other one is you have many times that many people, each of whom lives for 80 years. Is one of those situations better than the other? And if so, isn't it the one where there's more people that get a little slice of the pie?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it, John. It's hard for me to think in terms of the good of the world where one's talking about comparing a lengthy life of a single individual and, let's say, two lives that are half that long. I don't know what's better from the point of view of the universe. I do think that the practical problems of overpopulation and limited resources are significant, and we would have to come to grips with them. But I don't think that those problems are the ones that have traditionally motivated philosophers in rejecting the idea of attractive immortality. The philosophers such as Heidegger and the contemporary philosopher who unfortunately passed away recently, Bernard Williams, they argued that immortality would be necessarily undesirable, but not for these practical reasons.
Yes, there's a question between whether immortality would be necessarily undesirable. That is, we can't really conceive consistently of its being good for the person who has it, or just contingently. And I think a lot of us, maybe including me and certainly some of our callers, have wanted to emphasize, don't forget about the contingencies of the actual world, which make immortality a bad thing for the rest of us if one person has it, and maybe not a good thing for him.
If you'd like to join
us,
give us a call at 415-841-4134. We're talking about immortality.
Also have a website, which is www.philosophytalk.org, and you can go to our website, find out more about Fisher, about Taylor, about me, about the one-minute philosopher, and about Amy Standen.
Yeah. We have a caller in the line, Robert in Berkeley. Welcome to Julian, in San Francisco.
Hello. My question has to do with pets. Suppose
pets.
Technology was to the point where I could live 500 or 600 years, and I decided I want my pet dog with me. Would it be ethical to apply that technology to a dog so it also would live 500 or 600 years?
I don't have any idea. Do you, John Fisher or John Perry?
Well, one of our colleagues, Chris Babanich, would certainly think it was ethical. He loves his dogs, I think, even more than he loves his fellow philosophers in the philosophy department. But what do you think, John?
Absolutely. Why not?
Why not? Robert in Berkeley is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Hi. I wanted to offer the example of the film Groundhog Day with Bill Murray.
Yeah.
As a practical thought experiment in living, maybe not forever, but a lot longer than anyone would expect.
Yeah.
And I think the point of the film was that for some people, at least, an extended life would result in, I think your example earlier, is it better for one person to live 600 years or, you know, six people to live 100 years each? I think Bill Murray shaped his life in the story into a much more complex and refined work of art. Even living in one place and doing one day over and over again.
Right.
At least that was the portrayal. Right. Whether we could accomplish that with our human qualities is another question.
John Fisher, well, one problem
that Groundhog Day refers to is that you can imagine certain pictures of immortality according to which we're just repeating ourselves over and over again. And I don't think anyone would find that an attractive form of existence.
Isn't that supposed to be the Nietzsche's test, though, of whether you've lived a good life? It's the myth of eternal return. He gives you your life again and say, would you do it exactly the same? And if you've done it well, you're supposed to say, yes, I would do it again, just that way.
I think it's controversial whether that was Nietzsche's idea. The whole idea of eternal recurrence is contentious. But here's a brief quote from Woody Allen's film, Hannah and Her Sisters. Millions of books written on every conceivable subject by all those great minds, and in the end, none of them knows anything more about the big questions of life than I do. Nietzsche, with his theory of eternal recurrence, he said that we live, we're going to live over and over again the exact same way for eternity. Great, that means I'll have to sit through the ice capades again. It's not worth it.
I do want to say that I like that movie of Bill Murray's, and he's got another one, Lost in Translation, that's good too. This guy is actually doing something with his life, becoming a better and better actor, or at least being allowed to act better and better. If he's listening, thanks, Bill, for your thoughtful movies.
Got one last call. James.
Hello?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people lack imagination. Immortality would be a fantastic thing. You could master all kinds of art forms. You could work on all kinds. You could solve the political problems, the poverty. I mean, there's no end to it.
I agree with you, James. Go, but
I think James and Ken and John Fisher should have a little three-bedroom condominium and live forever with each other with all this enthusiasm.
I think it would have to be a big condominium.
So, John, thanks for joining us. It's been a really great discussion.
John, you've become a very wise philosophy professor after starting out as an undergraduate at Stanford. I hope your undergraduate years at Stanford had something to do with your present accomplishments.
Well, I remember many pleasant days in the sunshine at Stanford, and I wish you the very best of luck with this great program, and hi, Ari, Zoe, and Tina.
Okay. You got to get that one in.
Thanks,
John. John Perry, have you learned anything? Are you ready to live forever now? I'm going to give you eternal life.
I've learned something. I'm going to go for an extra 15 years over what I was planning before we started the show. That's just to show I'm open and objective and so forth.
Yeah, I think life is so intrinsically good that if you could live a good human life and you were always given another day, you'd always take it. And so you'd end up living forever. I just can't imagine it running out. Yeah. But, you know, I'm a putz, I guess. I don't know. An optimistic putz.
Well, if one of us has to live forever, I hope it's you.
Okay. In a quandary? Why not give us a call? We won't solve your problems, but we'll make them a whole lot more complicated than you ever thought they could be. A little something we call a conundrum. To confound us with your conundrum, contact us at philosophytalk.org.
Our next caller did just that. Let's welcome Lisa.
Where are you calling from, Lisa?
I'm calling from San Carlos.
Where is that? In the San Francisco Bay Area?
It's in the Bay Area.
It's a little town somewhere between Millbrae and Palo Alto.
Right.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us your conundrum, Lisa?
I worked for 10 years at a university in the area. And at this institution was a very, very, very excellent daycare.
Uh-huh.
I have two children. One is 5 and one is 2.5. The 2.5-year-old made it partway through, and I left the university, so I lost my affiliation.
Yeah.
So my younger child can't go to this institute anymore. And
that's
I've
sad.
Been seeking alternative daycare for him, but I can't find anything that even comes close to the quality that I had.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm looking to re-enter the workforce at this same establishment, and I could lie and say I've already got a job and I could get my daycare back, and since I'm going to be getting a job there eventually, you figure, well, I'll catch up with it. But I know the people that work at this daycare, and some of them are friends of mine, and I respect them a lot, and I really like them, so I really don't want to lie to them.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, my child's daycare is extremely important to me.
I mean, you can think of this question in two ways, it seems to me. There's an age-old conflict between what people sometimes call prudence, or let's just call that self-interest, and there's morality or fairness or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you just think in a self-interested manner without considerations of morality, you can ask the question, is it worth it? Is it in my self-interest to lie to these people for the benefit of myself?
So what are the risks of getting caught? How embarrassed would you be? Would you lose the possibility of getting the job you want?
Are you a good liar?
They don't check very carefully. All you have to do is fill out a form.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But let's say that prudentially, that is in terms of your own self-interest and those of your family, your own extended self-interest, it looks like the answer is, yeah, from a prudential point of view,
right,
you should do it. But now how about from a moral point of view?
That's different.
That's a good question. The philosopher Kant thought that rules like don't lie were just terribly important.
Yeah, he thought they were absolute.
But now what do you think about people that lie to you even because it's in their self-interest? I mean, do you get mad at them?
Well, can you give me an example? I mean, it would depend on the situation.
Well, suppose that you had fixed a lunch for your son at daycare and you drove to daycare to drop it off. And you gave it to a woman who had forgotten to fix a lunch for her son, but she didn't tell you that. Instead, she said, oh, I'll give it to your boy. Mm-hmm. So she lied to you, and then she gave the lunch to her boy, and her boy got a nice lunch, and yours didn't. So it was clearly in her and her boy's self-interest to lie to you, and she did lie to you. Now, would you be mad at her?
Yes, I would, but I see a difference.
What's the difference?
I'm not bringing harm to somebody else by lying.
Oh, wait a minute now. I thought you said this was the world's greatest daycare.
Aren't there people waiting?
Aren't there people waiting?
Yes.
Aren't there people who have the status, the required status, who would be waiting?
Oh, yes, I guess so.
isn't that harm?
It wouldn't be much different than the woman who took the sandwich.
Yeah, but can I tell you something else that complicates it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I know also for a fact that there are a couple of people there who are not affiliated, but they're friends of the people who are directing the program.
This is a moral swamp here.
Yes.
The institution apparently is not very vigilant in the enforcement of their own policies.
And
that's their responsibility, not hers. So maybe she wouldn't be in the wrong. Maybe the institution's in the wrong, but there's no complaint against her.
And I think at a certain point that becomes the right way to look at it.
Yeah.
The place I work has little signs up in all the rooms, no food or drink. But nobody pays attention to them. And, what's the point? I mean, why would I wouldn't feel the least bit guilty about violating that rule.
I think you shouldn't go out of your way to deceive them. But right? if they choose not to verify your offered employment history, they're failing. I think they're morally failing.
I think if Kant is listening, he may write you a letter, Ken.
Yes,
and
I
say,
know.
Get
He's
off
such
my
an
bandwagon.
Absolutist. He's such an absolutist. Well, I hope we've given you at least some means of thinking in philosophical ways about your conundrum, Lisa.
Yeah. Did bring up a few things I hadn't thought of.
Okay. It was nice talking to you,
Lisa.
Okay,
thank you.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2004.
The executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Our massive production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jem Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, and Alan Acosta.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Hedy Jacobowitz.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwall Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from the provost's office at Stanford University. Thanks to the provost for leaving his office open so we could get some support. The Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The wacko views expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
Or of anybody else in their right mind. For more information on the web, visit philosophytalk.org.
Thank you for listening. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.